Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Mr. Beacon podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, scaling IoT with battery-free Bluetooth.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This is our first recording in our new studio, and I am very pleased to have Sean Van Tine with me today. Sean, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Sean, you are a writer, a public speaker, a consultant specializing in user experience, customer experience, user interface design, and this podcast supposedly is about beacons, but I think one of the things that characterizes
supposedly about beacons.
Supposedly, because actually we cover a lot of things that go way beyond beacons, and you're not like a beacon guy.
No.
You've done projects where there may have been beacons involved, maybe. But the way I like to, I mean, for me, this is really just an excuse to talk to interesting people that can teach me things.
Interesting people and me.
Well, you are doubly interesting because, you know, this podcast probably wouldn't have happened but for you. Because you were one of the people, when I was thinking about writing a book, you and I went out for coffee. You were very generous with your time, and you basically schooled me on writing books. And you've written how many books?
I've written a few books.
And so generally on the topic of...
So my most recent book, which probably isn't that recent anymore, is called Easy to Use 2.0. Mm-hmm. It's a very niche book. It's about user experience in agile development for enterprise software. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wrote that book is because I've been in the enterprise space doing user experience for more than a couple of decades now and saw the rise of agile development. And I'm a big fan of agile development. Mm-hmm. What a lot of organizations were struggling with when they were adopting Agile was how does user experience fit into that? And I helped a lot of companies as an employee and then also as a consultant, a lot of enterprise software companies. And I thought, you know what, I should probably just, you know, kind of write the handbook for this. And it's been pretty well received. I get a lot of good feedback about, oh my God, thanks for explaining that to us, or... Obviously, it also ends up, you know, being kind of a calling card, like, hey, you're the guy that wrote that book. Can you help
Absolutely.
Us with that? So that's my most recent book. Hard to believe, about a decade ago, Jeffrey Bean and I did the customer experience revolution. Customer experience back then was kind of a new word, right? There wasn't a whole lot of books on it. I think Gene Bliss, Chief Customer Officer, was probably the only book and was actually the inspiration for us. And interesting, because Jeff and I got to speak on the same stage with Gene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, that's a whole other story.
Well, I'm listening to his book, and it still has relevance now.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Very prescient.
Yeah, and the customer experience revolution did really, really well. It's sold over 10,000 copies, which if you have a book out there, that's a pretty good number.
Yeah.
You know, most books don't sell over 1,000, so,
right.
You know, so that's been really good. And it's used in, I know it's used in universities and organizations around the world. I know when Oracle rolled out their customer experience, they used our book as their training book, and obviously UCSD uses it because Jeff teaches the course on marketing.
All right. And you teach at UCSD sometimes as well.
Yeah, I'm more of a guest lecturer. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was there last week. They have this new course called D4SD, or Design for San Diego. And I was involved with the early concepts of it through working with Donald Norman at the Design Lab. And now it's an actual course. And it's a very exciting relationship between UCSD Innovation and the City of San Diego. So using students in the community to solve city problems using design thinking. Mm-hmm. So I was there last week talking about specifically prototyping and where prototyping plays in the larger role of innovation.
So we've kind of scratched the surface a little bit, but hopefully provided some basic introduction to your background. So let's just wrap up the why the conversation piece of the introduction, which is, Bluetooth beacons, proximity technology, real-time location systems, they're compelling applications. I think they're still driving a lot of work. We're really just starting on this journey of being able to track everything and knowing how to connect it to the Internet of Things. But all of that technology is useless if it doesn't result in an application that human beings can engage with. Mm-hmm. And when I wrote the Beacon Technologies book, we tried to take a holistic view. We looked at alternative technologies. We looked at the supporting systems around beacons. And I think user experience design and looking at the customer journey are all essential if you're going to be successful. And, maybe people have been successful without thinking about it, but it definitely helps if you do. At a personal level, when I was at Qualcomm, we had a great user experience team, and we would get so many amazing ideas and insights by listening to users, interviewing them.
Yeah. And they have a great team.
It's really the difference between success and failure. So yes, we want to tell people about the latest protocols, but we also want to give people some tools and some insights into what will make projects successful. So that's why you're here. Mm-hmm. You helped me get the ideas formulated to publish my book. And I think I always have a lot of respect for consultants who see many, many different customers and see the patterns of what works, what doesn't work.
Oh, yeah.
And you've done that. And also you've had to do the hard work of sitting down and structuring your ideas. And they say the best way to learn is to teach, but I actually think writing goes even further because you got to get it right. You're held to account. Down there in black and white.
That's interesting. That's probably true, being having both a background in teaching and writing. But writing's a lot harder than teaching, that's for sure.
So before we jump into what is the difference between a user interface and customer experience and user experience and getting some terminology sorted out, just let's finish off how you got into this business at all. I mean, we were talking earlier, you're an artist. I can tell from your shirt you're still an artist at heart. How come you're doing what you're doing?
By the way, I used to hide the fact I was an artist for probably a good 15 years.
All right.
Yeah. So, I have a BFA in painting, and I spent most of my life as an artist. I'd get up every day and go to my studio, and I'd paint, and I teach in the afternoons and have exhibits, and I've sold work all over the world as an artist. But when we had our first child living in San Diego, it just wasn't a consistent enough revenue stream to buy a house in a nice neighborhood with good schools, i.e. Poway, because we knew that's where we wanted to end up. So I was going to make this career switch. I just finished doing my master's in education with a thesis in art integrated education, because at the time I was involved with the San Diego Aesthetic Institute doing artisan residencies, helping school systems integrate art into their educational program. Not surprisingly that when a learner, regardless if they're adult or they're a child, when a learner learns through art, they tend to remember the information longer and better. And they've shown this with standardized testing. So people that get that obviously want to integrate art into their curriculum. So that's kind of where my head was at going into my master's. This is like back in the 90s. And I had friends, though, who were software engineers. And when I was looking for something that I felt was just as creative as being an artist or a teacher, but also was relevant and I'm kind of a change junkie, so I kind of wanted something that was constantly evolving, my software friend said, well, that's what we do as software developers. We make software, and the technology is always changing, and it's really interesting. And I was like, man, I don't know if I can make that kind of a switch, right, with my art and education background. But it was the 90s, and if you remember what the 90s were, it's like there was such a shortage of technologists, and anyone who really wanted to kind of jumped in. So I started out back in IT doing database architecture and network architecture, ironically at Frazee Paint, whose headquarters was in San Diego. And then there's this thing called the internet that came along, and it looked pretty interesting to me. So I kind of refocused on web development and web design. And then by the late 90s was when the whole dot-com thing, you know, started exploding. And I got to work at a really good dot-com and kind of rode that wave from boom to bust. And then, of course, you know, it all came to an end at the beginning of this century. But by then, I definitely had developed my technology chops and my experience design chops. And I parked it at Mitchell International. Started out in their global architecture team as a UX architect, but eventually became their head of design and grew them a design department, which I'm happy to say is probably bigger now than back in the day that I was there. Then I consulted again for a while until the crash of 2008. And then I parked it at FICO. A lot of people think about the FICO score.
Yes.
But at the core, at the core of what they do is predictive analytics. So a lot of machine learning and predictive analytics. A lot of people don't know they were the original recommendation engine for Netflix.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they provide a lot of the marketing strategy background for companies like Coca-Cola or Target. Yeah, if it's they've been big data predictive analytics before people were even using those terms.
So why do they care about user experience?
Well, because at the my target in most of those cases were data scientists. So data scientists are developing models and scoring systems. They too need an interface to be able to look at that data, a lot of big data information architecture and things like that. But we're also sometimes dealing with strategists at company who want to play around with the strategy models. So you have to create an interface that's simple enough for the strategist who may not be a data scientist to give them some kind of easy tools for them to visualize how their strategy is going to work and create their champions and challengers without having to bring in the data scientists. Or in some cases like Coca-Cola, we were dealing with their folks in marketing who were developing marketing strategies. So that was a fun client, helping to figure out, you know, who their persona was and helping them figure out kind of their whole strategy around marketing.
So you dropped some terms in that I want to double click on. So you were talking about champions and challenges?
Yeah, so in machine learning, you might call it multivariance testing, which means that whenever you have a model and you want to see how successful that model is, you can test it against other models, right? In machine language, we have a thing called champion challenger, which means we have a current model that's running today that is getting the success that we want, but someone will develop what's called the challenger model.
Oh, okay.
And then we'll test the challenger against the champion.
Okay.
And if the challenger wins, then it becomes the new champion.
Interesting. So let's, again, take a step back and look at, I've asserted that user experience is important, and I think we can all relate to bad user interfaces a turnoff, good user interfaces are compelling. But what is it that causes companies to bring you in and go from, I think we can handle this ourselves, to we need help?
Yeah, so I credit a lot of this to Apple. You know, Apple is definitely one of the most profitable companies in the world, was the most profitable. I think they're second most profitable right now. And I think a lot of business people were looking at Apple and were saying, wow, why is Apple so successful? And Apple will tell you it's all about the user experience. That's all they think about. You know, Johnny Ives is king, and Steve Jobs himself was a great experienced designer. Also had a creative background. It was it was his interest in calligraphy that actually led to the graphic user interface, and his interest in fonts. And hey, we should offer a bunch of fonts, right?
Yeah.
So I credit Apple in general for businesses being interested in user experience, because if one of the most profitable companies in the world says the reason we're profitable is because of the user experience, then that's something. I think also Amazon's a pretty, pretty profitable company. And Jeff Bezos from day one said, I want to be the most customer-centric company in the world. I mean, there's a reason why he named it Amazon and not online bookstore, right? He knew at the beginning that books was going to be his foray into creating an online shopping experience for what would eventually be everything, right? I mean, what foresight. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, for the first, well, you probably do, for the first 9 years, he showed no profit. And, you know, the stakeholders weren't happy about that. And he kept on putting it back into the experience. Now, the interesting thing between Apple and Amazon is, do you know who Larry Tesler is? Larry Tesler just passed a couple days ago. Larry Tesler is the guy who came up with copy and paste.
Oh.
And he was Steve Jobs' chief scientist at Apple. And then he went for Jeff Bezos and became the VP of shopping experience there. We interviewed him in our book, The Customer Experience Revolution. Super nice guy, super smart, you know, was there at the beginning of the whole, you know, how do you design software experience? I mean, cut, copy, and paste. I mean, it's like, I can't imagine life without cut, copy, and paste, but he's the guy who thought of it. It's like, hey, there should be some way to graphically cut, copy, and paste, right? I've meandered down some roads.
No, no, that's fascinating. I was just stuck on the cut, copy, and paste thing, and I was trying to think back to when it was, because I remember finding out about that and just thinking, this is just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like Parks Lab, you know, back in the day.
Okay.
So why do people hire me? I think that was the question.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I answered it in a very broad way. It's again, businesses want to make profit, and they want to be profitable. And when they look at some of the most profitable companies, the CEO is the person to say, user experience or customer experience is what drives our revenue growth. So then they look within themselves, and they say, do we really have someone that knows how to do it? And to be honest, my customers could be one or the other thing. If it's a large company like a Sony PlayStation, it's probably going to be someone like the head of product who's going to bring me in to help them, you know, reorganize their, you know, their department. Or in the case of like Netgear, the head of design brings me in kind of as a partner to help him, you know, decide what's the next growth. For smaller or medium-sized companies, they don't have a head of design. So I kind of play that interim head of design role, and I'll help them based on their market, help them design a process that, you know, works for them. And sometimes we'll help them actually hire their head of design. I do that quite a bit, or other resources they need.
And I'm sure every client is different, but if you've got a client who has got an application which has got a horrible user interface, or maybe they just know that they need a good one and they're developing something, what's the process? What's at a general level, how do you help them? What do you do?
Sure. So to me, it's research, design, and test. So if they have a current solution in the market, be it an application or an enterprise solution or even a service, really doesn't matter to me what it is. They have an experience that they are delivering. They have even in a larger context, they have a brand promise that they're delivering, and they may or may not be delivering it well, or they may not be really aware if they're meeting that promise. That's kind of at the grandiose customer level. But when it comes right down to the application, this is really the difference between user experience and customer experience. I hate the term user, but the user experience is where the customer touches the products or the services and interacts with them, right? So when we say customer experience, we're really talking about their thoughts and feelings about the brand, usually. And you're usually talking to marketing folks like the CMO. When you're talking about user experience, you're usually talking to the product folks or the technology folks about that actual interaction. Like you mentioned, the user interface, that's one aspect of the interaction. Typically what we'll do in engagement is we will evaluate the current solution or user interface. And in my industry, it's been pretty standardized for a few decades. There's a thing that we call heuristics. There's 10 standard heuristics that we measure against. So we'll go through an application, maybe screen by screen, and based on that criteria, give it a score, right? And then based on that score and those findings, we can go back to the client and say, hey, we did an evaluation of your current solution, and here's how we scored it. Based on these findings, here are our recommendations of what kind of changes you'd make.
And give me some examples of those heuristics.
So probably one of the most simple ones are around information architecture. Mm-hmm. And information architecture is the organization of the information or content. Mm-hmm. So it could get into like the top level navigation. Does it make sense to your end user? Terminology is a big thing, right? Because a lot of companies design things inside out, and they'll think of, here's the best way to think about it. Have you ever been to a website and that company's website tells you what it does, mm-hmm. but it doesn't tell you what it does for you? Mm. So that's a very important distinction. Mm-hmm. And most companies make this mistake. There's so much inside their head, they think about what we do, mm-hmm. instead of thinking in terms of their audience, who really doesn't care what they do. Mm-hmm. They just want to know, what is the benefit to me? Mm-hmm. How are you going to help me? Mm-hmm. And we help a lot of companies kind of change that language from this is what you do to this is what you do for your audience. So
how do you avoid kind of getting obnoxious and salesy versus the positive side of that, which is here's why I should even bother spending any time with this tool? How do you
get
that balance?
I'm not a salesy guy at all. I'm very data-driven. So every decision that I make or anyone on my team makes, they have to know every element of that design and the data reason why that's there. It could be because it's a standard best practices. Like, oh, well, that's the right contrast because we know people who are farsighted. Mm-hmm. The font needs to be this size, and mm-hmm. the contrast from the background color and the foreground color needs to be this. Mm. Or it might come out of a test. It's like, oh, the reason that we're using this terminology or this particular grouping of information in a menu is because we tested it with 10 people, and 8 out of 10 said this is what they call it, and this is the order they want to see it in. Mm-hmm. That's the best. Mm-hmm. The best is when the data comes from the actual target audience. But in lieu of that, there's all kinds of industry standards about when to use radio buttons versus when to use a drop-down and, you know, hierarchy of information. There's books and books on this subject. Fitts' Law, I could go into all of it. But me and people in my field, this is the stuff that, you know, we drink and eat. So we already have this kind of standard understanding of how information or content should be presented. Uh-huh. There's all kinds of rules around mm-hmm. that and industry standards around that. Mm-hmm. And then you layer on top of that an understanding of the target audience, hopefully from talking to them.
Yeah.
And it's the two of those that makes it work for that particular brand.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you that, let's say, in the case of a website, because we deal a lot with websites, you know, websites inherently are written in hypertext markup language, or HTML, and there is a particular semantics to that language, and if you understand that semantics, that will get you 90% there. You know, mm-hmm. just writing the code the way it's supposed to be written will get you 90% there. The other 10% is what's individualized for your particular target audience.
Okay. So you have these 10 heuristics. Part of it is the information architecture, the way the information is organized on the page, which mm-hmm. is serving the purpose and the benefits that someone gets out of the thing. And what are some of the other things? The right choice of the right widget to drive the thing,
yeah.
Sliders versus radio buttons.
Sure,
versus...
So that's the interaction part of it. But the other aspect of it is the visual design. And visual design has kind of own language. So for example, most people know what the save icon looks like. Mm-hmm. And when they see it, they'll click on it and they know it's going to save something. Mm-hmm. But you and I and maybe people of our age know that that symbol is actually a floppy disk, which
right.
doesn't even exist anymore.
I know, it's
right?
amazing, isn't it?
So so metaphors, you know, like that. I swear to God, I was just having this conversation yesterday about, I was helping a client and they were using a tab metaphor, mm-hmm. right? And that whole tab metaphor comes from file folder systems. Mm-hmm. So if you imagine that you have a stack of file folders, they have these tabs. But the tab of the one that's open, that tab should be the same color as the file that's open, mm-hmm. and the rest of them should be anything but that color.
Yeah.
It could be gray or blue or whatever. And it's interesting how that tab metaphor has somehow gotten lost. And you'll see like the active tab be like, I don't know, blue, but the actual page is white. And one of the simplest things that you can do is say, no, make the tab the same as the background, because the metaphor is a tab for a folder.
Right.
And they've forgotten what it is. They've forgotten that the desktop is a metaphor for a desktop.
Right.
A folder is a metaphor for a folder. And going back to the roots of the what the real world metaphor means, a lot of interaction design and visual design is about understanding the root metaphor and where it comes from. And these metaphors are constantly changing. So for example, I'm dating myself. I remember when the breadcrumb came about. That's like, you know, you see an underlined link, and there's some kind of path, and it mm-hmm. kind of, it can either show you your physical path of where you went, or it can reveal the directory structure of whatever it is that mm-hmm. you're in, depending on how they're using the breadcrumb metaphor. But believe it or not, back in the 90s, people didn't understand it and didn't use it, and it was only used as a secondary way of navigating. And because of mobile devices, and because of the small space, it's become now a primary form of navigation. So that's what's happened. That's how it's evolved over the last 20 years. Another great example is the hamburger menu. The hamburger menu is like those three lines, mm-hmm. and we know now if you see the three lines, if you click on it, you're going to get a hidden menu.
Yeah.
Right. That came from the mobile world because the space was so small.
Yeah.
But you've seen it be now adapted in websites or even applications. Mm-hmm. So these are the things I get excited about. I get excited about metaphors, the origin of the metaphor.
Yeah.
What does the metaphor really mean? Part of my job is to be able to identify the difference between a fad and a trend. Like, mm-hmm. So for example, design got really, really flat. Design got so flat that you couldn't tell if something was clickable. It just went to that extreme.
Yes.
Remember that?
I remember Johnny Ive did that thing because everything was being rendered with curves and shiny stuff. And it was, and for a while it was like, this is clearly the best way. This is the best user interface. And then they had this flat thing.
They went way too flat. So,
it was a fashion.
In all fairness, Johnny Ive is an industrial designer. Mm-hmm. So, so he's the one who determined like the clam shape. Mm-hmm. on the laptops and the mm-hmm. phones. And I mean, Johnny Ives isn't perfect either. As you may recall, the first iPhone had the same clam shape as the laptop did, and it was hard to hold, and it kept on slipping out of the hand. Mm. And then in the next design, they did the flatter mm-hmm. side. Mm-hmm. So that's just, you know, the evolution of, and that's an industrial design, right?
Yeah.
So when Johnny tried his hand at, you know, software or screen design, you know, I don't think that was the right color palette, and it was way too flat. I think the recovery from that was Google, of all companies, because Google really didn't invest heavily in visual design, and then they realized they had this disparity, so they created a centralized design team, and eventually, I think now they have wonderful design. And mm-hmm. what they did was they took flat design, but they added just a little bit of a hint, a metaphor of a shadow. Mm. So now a button looked like a button. It's like, oh, now this looks clickable.
Yeah.
In my world, we call that affordance. Mm. Affordance means that when you look at something, you know what to do. Like in the real world, you'll sometimes come up to a door to a building and it's like, do I push this or pull this?
Oh, yeah.
Right? So if you can't tell at a glance, that door has poor affordance.
Yes.
But if you can tell, it has good affordance.
Yes.
Same thing's true in the software world. Does it look clickable or not?
Getting this stuff right is so important. I mean, as users, we tend to beat ourselves up when we get lost.
As people, we tend to beat ourselves up when we get lost.
And generally, it's, you know, the reason we got it wrong is because of poor design.
There's an old joke, by the way, in my world.
Right.
There's only two professions that refer to their customers as users. Software and drug dealers.
Yeah.
Which is why I try to avoid, even though everyone knows what user experience is, I try to call it either customer experience or experience design.
Interesting.
Because it's about people. It's about people's interactions with technology that's constantly evolving
and okay. people's interaction with people.
Well, that's a good segue to maybe the next topic, which, so there's the heuristics, you kind of score what people are doing, you have a set of principles you can use to do it better. And you've several times talked back to, I think you've suggested kind of empathizing with the target customer, I was mm-hmm. about to say user. I hear people talk about personas and that sort of thing. Uh-huh. And I have to say, I had a initial negative reaction towards that. It just seems so bizarre that, because my experience of people designing personas is you start creating these elaborate stories about these people, and I kind of wonder, well, what are we actually doing with this? And so tell me, what are personas? Why use them? When can they really be helpful?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I'm very pro-persona.
Right. I would expect so.
And persona-driven. So personas actually started with Greek theater. So in Greek theater, there was the role and the actor and then the persona. Back in the early days of psychology, like Freudian psychology and Jungian psychology, personas took on a whole new life in the realm of psychology. A persona, kind of the same thing as what the Greek theater is referring to, but more in a psychological profile. Mm-hmm. Then in the 1950s, U.S. marketers started using persona to kind of take their marketing segmentation to a whole other level. Then in the late 1990s, what was the book? The Inmates Are Running the Asylum was written. And that was the first time that personas were used for a software development. Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, a persona is a fictional representation of a group of people that share the same goals. So mm-hmm. In the software world, that could go across roles, like system roles. It could also grow across segments, like market segments. And the reason you care about the groups in terms of goals is because since they share the same goals, they share the same objectives, they probably have the same pain points, they probably have the same, you know, barriers of entry, and they're probably measuring success the same way. Mm-hmm. And I've been developing personas for a long time now. Mm. And the wonderful thing about personas is that once a company adopts a persona, I've seen personas being used by the salespeople to work out the sales story or pitch mm-hmm. that they're gonna tell. Mm-hmm. I see that same story used, that same persona used by marketing mm-hmm. to determine the market message. Mm-hmm. I've seen that same persona used by the people designing the product and service, right? Because that's the same person. Obviously, as a designer, the persona is what guides me, because if I know the persona, right? Then I know what colors to use. I know what metaphors make sense to them, right? And that will really guide my design decisions. I understand what their goals are. I understand what the barriers of entries are. Mm-hmm. So I can design a solution that eliminates those barriers and those pain points and is more focused on the way that they want to see information. The personas also tell you who to invite into your usability studies. Which kind of leads to the next phase. We talked about the heuristic review, mm-hmm. like look at the current solution and identify opportunities for improvement. Mm-hmm. Well, once you do that, then there's this whole iterative prototyping cycle where you design something and you want to review it either with subject matter experts inside the organization that hopefully are a good representative of the target audience, or even better, review it with the target audience as you iterate, and they can give you brutal feedback like, no, I'd never call it that, or that's stupid. Why did you group it that way? Or, no, I wouldn't want to do that. I'd want to do this first. And, hey, where's this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, true story. I once had a client designed recommendation engines. This was like 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
For companies like The Gap and Victoria Secrets.
The client was designing a recommendation engine, and they, like I said, they had some very big clients,
mm-hmm.
so it's a B2B model. And their target audience were the marketers. But we did some preliminary research, and I said, you know, I really want to understand, I want to profile your companies. These aren't necessarily personas, but just company profiles. And I think you can relate to this. They said, we find that our clients fall into three buckets. There are those that don't even touch our recommendation engine, and they see a steady return on investment, and they're happy. He goes, there's another group that are always, you know, tweaking it, right? Because we give them the tools to do that,
mm-hmm.
And they're usually screwing themselves because
mm-hmm.
they don't know what the hell they're doing. He goes, and then there's a small percentage of really strategic people, you know, strategic clients that actually know how to tweak it and actually can get a little bump out of it,
mm-hmm.
right? So I said, okay, that's great. I go, as we're designing the new interface for them, let's make sure we get a good mix of them and review the designs. And mm-hmm. at this point, the designs are just paper prototypes or what we call wireframes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had 5 days. On Monday, we met with client A in the morning, and we walked them through the new screen designs, just clicking through some paper prototypes. ton of feedback, right? Took all kinds of notes. That afternoon, I probably spent a couple of hours making changes based on what the first client had said. They also had some ideas, some things that I didn't think about, the client didn't think about, added those in.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday morning, we meet with client two, show them the updated design based on the feedback we got from the first client. Got more great feedback. I think we got another really good idea, but probably maybe spent an hour making changes.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday, client three. So at this point, client three is benefiting from any insights we got from the first two clients.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at it, they had some good feedback, nothing new, but some tweaks. Mm-hmm. Maybe spent a half hour that afternoon
mm-hmm.
making revisions. Thursday, client four. They loved it. They had very little feedback. I maybe spent a few minutes changing some things. Friday, client five, showed it, loved it, no suggestions. I kid you not. But the point of the story is the power of iterative review and revision with your target audience.
Yes.
The key to that is knowing who your target audience is, because
yes.
if you're reviewing it with the wrong people, you're not going to get results. And one of the things that happens, especially in big companies, is that they think the person that knows their target market is someone internally in the company.
Yes.
So they have this one data point.
Yes.
And that one data point could be terribly wrong.
Yeah.
Where talking to your actual customers is really the key to success.
And how do you decide how many personas you should have?
Oh, statistically, personas.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say how many people you need to interview to make a persona.
Well, that's another interesting question to
yeah,
answer.
Five, statistically. So there's been analysis on this. And if you talk to five people that match your target. So when you're developing personas, which is fun to do. Well, I'm a geek. I think it's fun to do.
Yeah.
But the first thing you do, how I do it at least, is I'll run a workshop internally, bringing in all the stakeholders of who they think the persona is.
Mm-hmm.
And this does a lot of wonderful things. First thing, it gets me up to speed on who they think their persona is,
mm-hmm.
right? So I can create what I call a proto-persona or a mm-hmm. straw man. But it's also interesting to see how diverse internally how the different silos think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beginning of the healing process.
Mm.
It's the beginning of internally the stakeholders and the leaders to realize that, oh, shit, we have these different perspectives on who our target is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bring them along as part of the process. So then I go back to them. I go, okay. And you usually end up with anywhere from 3 to 5 personas.
Mm-hmm.
And then you say, okay, well, I need to talk to 5 each of these. And it can really vary because you might want to look across
segmentation, demographics, there's lots of different things you might. Mm-hmm. So even for five, I might still end up talking to 50 different people because mm-hmm. there's all these different ways that they want to, that's important to them and their company. Mm. So you do the analysis, i.e. you conduct the interviews. And then you come back with a revised version of the persona that you started with, your proto persona. And you sit down with them and you tell them that, hey, based on the interviews and the people that you identified, it's really not five personas, it's really three. And what you thought were your primaries, turns out they're not your primaries, turns out these are your primaries. So you do the analysis. You talk to people and you come up with, now obviously a lot of it is subjective and qualitative, but a lot of it is quantitative too. I mean, you can start adding things up. Like out of these five people, all five of them said this was their pain point, that was right. their barrier, that yes. was their goal. So five out of five said that for that persona, then we know that that's true for that persona. So that's how you use both qualitative and quantitative methodologies to develop the persona to make sure that you have the right target audience when you are reviewing whatever the solution may be. It could be a product, it could be a service, but the methodology remains the same.
And the last part of that is the testing, usability testing.
Yes.
And usability testing comes in at least two forms, formative and summative. Formative means any kind of testing you would be doing prior to the release of the product or service, and summative means any testing that you do after the release of the product and services. So if you're thinking about Internet of Things, right, there's probably a lot of formative testing that you could do with a prototype to really enhance whatever that experience needs to be with that device and that space or however it's being used. So that's called formative testing. And formative testing tends to be iterative. The prototypes tend to be very lightweight, but it informs the final product or service. Mm-hmm. After the product or service has been done, then you do summative testing, which means the product is real, it's out in the real world, and we're gonna find out, now that it's been out in the real world, how's it doing? Mm-hmm. And if you did a good job with your formative testing, right, you probably already have your criterias of success, and then you can find out if how well did you match those criterias of success in the summative mm-hmm. testing. Also, what comes out of the summative testing, not only can it tell you how successful you were at whatever your usability criterias were, but it also can inform the next iteration of whatever your product is, right? It's like, hey, you know, we identified in the formative testing that this was something that people really cared about. We knew we weren't going to get it in this release, and sure enough, that ended up being an issue in the summative testing. So let's, you know, that can help drive the priorities for the next iteration of, you know, whatever the product or service is that you're developing.
I've had such fun being a participant and a spectator in this. I found it so valuable. Back in Qualcomm days, they have these amazing user experience labs, and you take prototypes and sometimes working products, and you put them in front of these very diverse sets of people who are often strikingly different from the people that are observing them, which is amazing.
Yeah, so that's one of the biggest challenges when you're running a study is people with a background in research or usability or cognitive science understand that there's a lot of bias involved, and you have to structure your questions and your response in a very tempered, particular way. That's, you know, we call it empathy, but really it's about, being able to listen without prejudice and not get too vested in the solution itself. Where, as you've already hinted at, there's people on the other side of that two-way mirror who might be the product owner or might be the developer or might be the designer, and they'll be yelling at them. It's like, no, it's that button. you idiot, why can't you know? So in and I've been in situations where people had to be asked to leave because
really
they care, and it's passion. They care about their product, they care about their solution.
Yeah.
Like I said, maybe they were the developer that wrote the code. Maybe they're the graphic designer that made that icon that they couldn't figure out. Maybe it's the product owner that just really knew it was a great idea, but the idea didn't evolve quite the way that they thought it would.
And the other thing I've seen also is like the subject, you bring these people in, and I remember we had folks testing this. It was a mobile app to, you could use it to pay for your gasoline and buy a carbon offset at the same time. And so we had like people who were actually quite wealthy, who they drove an Audi and da-da-da, and then there was other people that didn't have a car, and we had them in. But the thing that really struck me is, as the person who hopefully wasn't screaming at them at the other side of the two-way mirror, was the people that were conducting the questions. It was like a psychotherapy session, because the subjects were, you're paying them, otherwise why are they going to go through this process? And they kind of want to please you. And so quite often it was like they wanted to give you the answer that they felt like you wanted.
Yeah, it's part of the bias that you have to control.
And the person that was facilitating the questions, it was like a psychotherapy session where you never, ever actually find out what's in the head of the therapist. The subject would say, so is this how I do it? And again and again, the interviewer would say, well, what do you think?
Yeah, exactly. It involves a lot of facilitation skills. And a big part of it is not giving it away. And it's something you tell them, so that when you run a study like this, a couple of things you tell them right up front is, number one, go ahead and ask the question that you're thinking, but know that I'm not going to answer it. We'll answer it at the end of the study, but because I want to know what you're thinking. We call it the thinking out loud protocol. So just give me your stream of consciousness. And women are much better at it than men are. Men need a lot of prodding, because you'll be sitting there, they'll be staring at a screen, and you have to prod them and go, so what are you thinking right now? Yeah. Like, I'm trying to decide if I need to push this button or go back. Well, why are you thinking that? It's like, well, I think if I push this button, this is going to happen. Well, why do you think that's going to happen? Well, because it says this. Is that what you want? It's like, no. I go, what do you want? Oh, I want this. Well, how would you expect to do that? Well, I think I would do this, but that's not there. And that's gems. I mean, just in those few sentences, I found out that that's not what he calls it. That's not what he's looking for. But he's looking for this, and it ain't there, right? So as a designer, you're doing this. Right? Yeah. And I'm going to tell you, I don't want to know how many hundreds of my own designs that I've tested, but I can tell you, I guarantee you, every time I've ran a study, there were things that I thought were obvious and easy that were not. Mm-hmm. But the ones that still blow my mind are the ones that I think, you know, they're going to struggle with this, and they don't. Mm-hmm. And it just goes back to you are not the target audience for this. Mm. So you design things for, let's say you're designing an application for nurses, right? And for me, this workflow doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and that's not what I'd call it. But, you know, based on the persona and the research I did, this is the way it should be. And I'm thinking, well, that's not gonna work at all. Sure enough, they go click, 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 because it totally makes sense to them. And that thing that I thought was brilliant that I designed, that little cool drop-down thing, they didn't see it, they didn't click on it, they completely missed it, right? And you just got to be humble. A big part of it is not just empathy and to be able to listen without prejudice, but the other part is the humility, just accepting that I thought it was a good idea, but I have to go back to the drawing board.
So I want to bring this back a little bit to beacons and indoor location and real-time location systems where you're tagging assets and so forth. So I can see how what we've described works for a web page or a mobile app. You have a mock-up and you use bits of paper to kind of prototype what the user experience might be, and then you rough something up very clunky and they use it and you get the feedback. What if I'm designing like a self-checkout experience and it's actually a retail store? It's a three-dimensional space. I've got
I've designed
maybe digital displays that respond when I pick something up. How do you prototype that?
Sure. So I've designed experiences for kiosks. We just did something a couple years ago with a casino where we were designing the casino experience. So how does the, all the way from, you know, what does the player receive in the mail or email or in text to what is their experience like getting to the casino, parking, the casino floor experience, what's their service like, what's the restaurant like, what's the hotel like? For many years, I worked with TEDx San Diego on the experience design team. So what's the experience like for people who are attending the TEDx talk, to the people who are on the stage, to the sponsors, right? The techniques and methodologies are still the same. The only difference is the type of experience. One of my favorites is, think about Disney, one of my favorite brands, right? They have a group of people they call Imagineers, and they're designing that whole experience around a ride. So they're thinking about, how do we make lines interesting? You know, how do we control where they're looking at as they're, you know, walking through the experience? Or how do we control what they're seeing, hearing, smelling when they're in the ride itself? The methodology is all the same, so it doesn't matter. So let's take an IoT example. I have a client now where they're in the construction space, right? And they're tagging things, you know, like tools, and they also have cameras and monitors that monitor, like, you know, carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, right? So that's a physical thing in a physical space, and it has its own challenges about, you know, what's its power source. The other interesting thing about a construction space is that it evolves. In other words, they're in this space now, but once they're done with that, they're going to move on to that space. So those devices need to be monitored and move with them. So there is the actual... there's the actual thing in the space, and what's that experience like for the people who have to install them or take them out or move them. And then there's also a counter online experience where people are going to want to monitor the data that's coming off of the device on a screen. It can be a mobile device or a tablet or a web page.
Yeah, so with the IoT, there's the person that's doing the in-store navigation, the shopper maybe that's trying to find the fruit or the pair of underwear that they want in the store. And then there's the user experience of the person that's kind of in the dark room that's using this data and trying to...
Yeah, like I said, I spent 6 years at FICO designing the data scientist experience. So they have to look at all the data that would come off of the device and, you know, hopefully make good decisions based on that. And at the end of the day, you're really helping people make better decisions. It could be making a better decision about, you know, I want to get my wife some flowers, right? Or it could be better decisions like, I want to make sure this nuclear plant doesn't explode. It could be better decisions like, I want to make sure that the flow around my iPhone is enough so it doesn't overheat. But it's all about decision making.
Very good. Well, Sean Van Tine, thank you so much for spending time with us. I believe you have a website.
Yes, I do. And it's under design right now.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Well, but I looked at it last night, and it looked pretty good to me. SeanVanTine.com?
Well, yeah, there's SeanVanTine.com, but VanTineGroup.com is really kind of the business side of the house.
All right.
But yeah, they're both under redesign. I was like, God, I got to get them done before this interview, but... it is what it is, right? It, too, is constantly evolving.
Very good. Well, this has been really educational. You've got books. You're out there consulting. It's been a treat talking to you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
So what would the... it's presumably a tough choice coming down to three songs that you'd take.
It was really tough. It became a Sunday breakfast conversation at the Van Tine house.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, and mostly between me and my 18-year-old daughter, Jackie. Because it's interesting to get their perspective on things, like, oh, Dad, you know, what do you like about this and what do you like about that? So I think the three that I came up with, if I can recall, one of them was Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes by Paul Simon. It's from his Graceland album. It won the Grammy that particular year.
It's fascinating. It's on my list as well.
Really? No, it's not. It's so obscure.
Oh, no, no.
And the reason it is, it's Laura's and I's song. So when Laura and I were dating back in the day, I'll never forget it. We were at her place, growing up in Michigan, in her basement, because we have basements in Michigan.
Right.
And we're watching Saturday Night Live, and Paul Simon was the musical guest, and he sang Diamond on the Soles of Her Shoes.
Oh, awesome.
And it's like that memory, right? So that has to be there. Other songs that I was thinking about, you know, being on Mars is nothing in particular, but something by Mozart, just because, you know, Mozart is very creative, and when I listen to Mozart, I used to listen to Mozart a lot in the studio. It just helps you free your mind and open things up. Mm-hmm. So,
and the studio is your painting studio.
Yeah, back in my younger days when I was an artist. Yeah, I still listen to Mozart though, like when I write. Mm-hmm. So Mozart's kind of my go-to. I'll put in nowadays we don't have headphones anymore. We have earbuds.
Right.
And it's funny when my kids call them headphones. It's like, no, that is not headphones. They are earbuds. It's the bud goes in your ear. It's not a headphone.
It's different.
Yeah, it's different. So definitely some Mozart.
Okay.
If I was on Mars, so I got something to remind me of my wife. I have something to listen to if I'm doing something creative.
Yeah.
The third one was really, you know, I don't know about the third one. I'm not sure if I could really come up with a third one. Maybe something. Maybe something like September by Earth, Wind, and Fire.
All right.
Something that, you know, you can get your groove on, right?
Yeah.
Something to remember my wife by, something to get some work done, and maybe, you know, something to move by. So there you go.
Wonderful choices. They're evocative for me as well. That's the great thing. That reminds me of being 17, just finishing up school, and we were growing up enough that they let us have a common area where we could listen to music. And that Earth, Wind, and Fire album was one that was played a lot.
So I must be a little bit older than you. Because when I think of Earth, Wind, and Fire, especially in their heyday, it was, again, growing up in Michigan, I have a very specific memory about basement parties.
So
when you grow up back east and people have basements in the wintertime, right, it's too cold to do anything outside, so you have these parties in the basement. And usually the parents, I'm in middle school, right? So, or we call it junior high, they call it middle school here. But like usually the parents are upstairs and, you know, they have all the snacks and the drinks and then the kids are downstairs listening to the music and dancing. And there's usually some more sophisticated couple in the corner who might be smooching or something like that.
A lot of memories.
Yeah.
Very good. Thanks so much.
Music and memories. You can't really separate
inseparable.
Them.
Inseparable. Yeah. Good choices.
Those
thank
are my
you.
My choices. You're welcome. Thank you for asking.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.